You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
Welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of the Body Pro. Right now, I'm in the poster session where researchers are standing in front of their posters. There's nothing like hearing the results of research directly from those who have actually conducted the research. It is these women and men who are transforming HIV treatment and care. In this podcast, the researchers will introduce themselves and then summarize their study. After their summary, I'll ask a few questions. One of the most talked about studies at CROI 2008 was one presented by Caroline Sabin on behalf of the large international DAD cohort. Their abstract was entitled, Do Thymidine Analogs, Abacavir, DDI, and 3TC Contribute to the Risk of Myocardial Infarction? I had the chance to catch up with Jens Lundgren, Chief Physician and Director of the Copenhagen HIV Program, where the DAD cohort is based. He'll summarize the data and discuss the ramifications of the results. Welcome, Dr. Lundgren. Could you summarize your study, please?
Sure. We looked at the nucleoside analogs to see whether the nucleoside analogs was associated with an altered risk of a myocardial infarction or heart attack. Before we started the analysis, our assumption was that if anything, it would be the two thymidine analogs, cytarabine and stavidine, that would be the culprit. And the analysis, as they turned out, showed that that was not the case. They were, in fact, not at all associated with that, which really surprised us because we thought that both those drugs had been associated with dyslipidemia and insulin resistance and diabetes, which are obviously intermediate to an excess risk of cardiovascular disease. So we thought that that should be then happening, but we didn't see that. But I think what we were even more surprised was that in proper diligence of analyzing this, we also tested some of the other drugs, assuming that they would at least be negative. But we found something different. We found that Bacavir was lightening up. And then we have spent 4 months here trying to disentangle what this means and what are this signal describing. And where we are at the moment is that we have been able to show that this associated risk with use of Abacavir is true as long as you take the drug. If you go off the drug again, that excess risk disappears again, suggesting that it is something to do with the drug while you have the drug in your body that may be associated with an altered risk of cardiovascular disease. Exactly what, if these associations are biologically real, what are the biological explanation? We don't know, but it's something to do with the drug itself, as opposed to something where it sort of leaves permanent damage also after it discontinues. I think it's very important to underline that this study is an observational study. It's not a randomized trial, and therefore the interpretation of the findings needs to be more cautious because an observational study cannot prove definitively causality between a drug and a given outcome like myocardial infarction. So clearly people need to make sure that they appreciate that limitation of the study design when they are reviewing the data. We have, of course, done that as well and thought long and hard about whether we can identify reasons other than drug itself that could explain these associations. And I must say we're not able to come up with a proper alternate explanation. So that leaves, of course, the possibility that this could be a biologically true effect.
Isn't it true, though, that patients who were probably put on either DDI or Abacavir were put there because they might have had risk factors for heart disease, and it was assumed that the other drugs might have exacerbated that?
Well, we checked that possibility quite carefully, and indeed there was, at least in some patients, it appears that those who were started and using Abacavir was at slightly higher risk of cardiovascular disease. But we checked for that in our analysis. What you do is statistically that you then start to adjust for those factors. And if that was the explanation, you would then expect the association with the drug to disappear. It didn't. It didn't affect it at all. And also, if it was that explanation, one would think that it shouldn't go away if you stop the drug, because then it's a subgroup of the patients with a given increased risk that you're studying, and of course that risk will continue also after they stop on the Abacavir. So that's not really consistent with what we're finding, that it is this so-called channeling bias. But of course we can't exclude the possibility that this is the explanation. If there were factors that we're not aware of that was leading to preferential use of these drugs, but I think we have done the best we can to understand and appreciate whether that's the explanation, and must say that we haven't found support for that.
Mm-hmm. So could you describe the risk? You know, the numbers are a little bit difficult to understand.
That's the problem, right? When you translate sort of complicated statistical analysis into something, so what does this mean, right? The number itself is 90% increased risk. So what does that mean? Well, it means we can all predict our underlying cardiovascular risk. And, you know, there's the Framingham equation, and there's other equations developed to predict. So, and these predictions essentially formulate which proportion of a given population that lives in the next 10 years will get a heart attack. And that prediction, so some people will have a very low risk, you know, less than 1% will develop a heart attack in the next 10 years, and other populations will have a very high risk, you know, 20% or 30% risk. But essentially how to think about this 90% is that placed into context with your underlying risk. So if your underlying risk is low, say a 0.5%, and then you add 90% on top of that, I mean, that's less than 1% still. So that's really a trivial problem, I would say, compared to all the other things that we have to worry about in our lives. But on the other hand, if you take a patient with a, you know, underlying risk of 20% or 30%, and then you add 90% to that, then it becomes a real deal. So at least that's our take on it at the moment, that if anything, people with a high underlying risk of cardiovascular disease, that's where you at least should start to consider whether this is the right drug to use.
And could you characterize the 20% Framingham risk for somebody who doesn't check those risk factors for a patient? I mean, would it be someone who's overweight, someone who...
I would say that if you haven't checked it, it's about time that you start, not only because of this study, but because I think that is a pivotal information to have when you are assessing preventive strategies, because we know that there's many modifiable risk factors like smoking, cholesterol, diabetes, etc., hypertension, that you can do something about. So you need to do that. So, but anyway, to answer your question directly, a patient who is usually a male of 45, 50 years old, if they're a smoker, if they have diabetes, that's the sort of patient that you would think about.
And tell me a little bit about the cohort. It's 33,000 patients?
Well, it's actually a collaboration of cohorts that has been ongoing since 1999 and is put together by a group of physicians and statisticians and other good people that were sort of concerned about what would happen if we continue to use these drugs for a long period of time. And so it's a rather unique, I would say, collaboration internationally where we focus very much on quality of the data that we put into the database. Each of the cohorts are in existence and do their own research, and then essentially for this particular question, we then merge it into one common database, and we quality assure the endpoints and to make sure that we get it right. So,
I see. Are there other HIV medications that increase the risk as well?
Well, that's an ongoing project. We published in the New England Journal of Medicine in April 2007 that the protease inhibitor drug class was associated with increased risk. But that was studying a class of drugs, not individual drugs. So we're currently working on studying which drugs in the protease inhibitor class are potentially the explanation for this, but we haven't got there yet.
So are there any plans for a randomized study now?
I would love to do a randomized trial. As a matter of fact, I would love to see many more randomized trials to assess these issues. I mean, of course, the issue about randomized trials is that these has to be very large, right? And they need to be long-term. And therefore, randomized trials cost a lot of money. But if we can generate the funds to do these trials, I think that's absolutely the best way to go, because that provides much more definitive information about these issues. The problem, of course, is that there is many different permutations of drug combinations that you can start to compare. And if each one of them requires a 10,000-patient study, you're going to use billions of dollars. I mean, although that's the sort of state of the art and the preferred way of doing it, it may not all happen. As a matter of fact, I mean, there's very few studies, randomized studies, which include several thousand patients. The biggest one in recent time is the SMART study that included 5,400 patients. You know, that's a little bit of our dilemma at the moment, that we want to get these drugs on the market, we want to get them quickly on the market because they help people to survive, and we should not put too much of a blockage from a regulatory point of view before they are released into the market. But as a consequence, the studies that is done to prove effect, what you call biological endpoint studies and not clinical endpoint studies. So you rely on the fact that these relatively small size studies fully describes the benefits and the risk of the drugs. And clearly that may or may not be the case. And certainly our study that we're now reporting raises the question of whether we actually have good enough information from the randomized trials that is used to get the drugs on the market to really ensure that we fully understand the benefits and the risks of using these drugs. And I think that's a fundamental dilemma that we have. I think it is an important area of discussion given the fact that we have to use these drugs for the rest of patients' life. So this is not a short-term treatment we're talking about, of course. It's decades of using these drugs, and we need to understand, I need to understand which drugs are causing which problems in my patients so I can start to talk to my patient about these problems and make sure that we address them as proactively as we can. I think that's the challenge that we are faced with.
But I think this study, as well as other studies at the conference, are showing that you have to look at the full health history of a patient before even prescribing medications, the HIV medications, because of all these factors, because certain drugs will have this problem. And sure, particularly with a combination of three, it's kind of an art to figure out which regimen will not, you know, yeah,
but
cause
that,
issues.
Isn't that amazing? You know, 5 years ago, we were all upset right. about CD4 cell count and myelone, and we still should, of course. But now we're starting to discuss underlying cardiovascular risk. I mean, it's a new mindset, right? And I think it just shows the maturity of the field. I mean, we're getting into a more mature understanding of the issues. Of course, we all appreciate that these drugs are saving lives and they should be used and it should be used appropriately. But we need to reflect a little bit more about whether we are doing the right thing, and we are doing the right thing, irrespective of what drugs we're using, of course. But can we, I mean, the challenge becomes, can we do it even better? And, you know, back in 96, 97, you needed a randomized trial of 100 patients to show benefit of a new drug. I mean, it was trivial, right? I mean, it was obvious that this works. Now we're talking about several thousands of patients. But that's how, if you look at cardiovascular research, I mean, they started up with small number of studies because it was obvious the benefits. But now they also do very large studies. So I think that's where the field has to move, because that's where the research questions now resides. And it needs these large studies to do that.
I want to go back to some more questions about the abacavir link. So was there any link seen with abacavir, the duration of the use of abacavir?
No. That was one of our surprises, because that's what we found when we studied the protease inhibitors, that the longer you had been on, the bigger the problem became. But that it was very different signal we found with abacavir, that it appears like that it's a fairly immediate onset of excess risk that is then maintained at the similar level irrespective of how long time you have actually used the drug, but not a higher and higher risk the longer you've been using it. So, and then it disappears, as I mentioned, once you go off the drug.
And that was true with DDI as well?
It looks like that's true for DDI. I mean, I would say that if you're used to looking at large numbers and large, you know, many results and so forth, there's some results, although they're statistically significant and whatever, that you're sort of more comfortable about than others. You know, that's not to discourage what we have been reporting, but I'm more comfortable about the Abacavir signal than the adenosine signal. It's a stronger signal, and therefore I'm more confident about that.
And tenofovir and FTC were not really compared in this because not enough patients were taking it, I understand?
Well, there's a lot of patients now taking tenofovir, but that's not going to cut it. You also need to have been using the drugs for a reasonable period of time.
And when you say reasonable, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, that depends on how many patients is on it. The more patients that is on it, the shorter period of time you need until you can start to analyze it. So I suspect that we will, within the next year or two, be able to look into tenofovir as well. But I don't think it is helpful to put out preliminary findings. That's certainly not how we have gone about reporting our findings. We want to, once we report it, it's because we're confident in the results, and we're just not confident in the tenofovir results yet. So it's just that there's only one way to fix that, that is to wait a little bit and have a little bit of patience. But I can guarantee you that we will report it when we feel confident, as we did with this.
I see you put out a position statement by the DAD steering committee. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I think I can sort of reflect the mood of the steering committee quite precisely by saying that we essentially didn't believe it. You know, we've tried over 3 months, from October when we first saw this until December, to disprove that what we have found.
Meaning your results were surprising to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't believe it. But of course, as you can understand,
because it was counterintuitive.
Not counterintuitive, because I wouldn't say that there's evidence that it would not be, but it was highly unexpected. And therefore, you know, you start to then worry, did we do an error, right? I mean, did we do something wrong in our analysis? I mean, these are huge statistical programs to deal with, you know, these huge data set. And, you know, there's many things that can go wrong in that process. But due diligence, 3 months, we came up with the same signal. So we said, we're not going to sit on this anymore. I mean, we're going to put this out. But we knew, at least we suspected, that people would get worried about this. And, you know, an abstract is, 200 or 300 words? I mean, it's a very limited space to actually explain this. And, of course, what we would hate to see would be that people reacted, what I would characterize as irrational to this report, starting to, you know, oh, I can't take these drugs anymore, or I need to drop that drug or something. I mean, that would be terrible. So we felt as a group that we had a certain responsibility to at least allow people to understand what we felt. So that was why we put this position statement out. So people at least have the possibility of reading that and understand where we are coming from, understand what we have found and understand our thinking around this, and including the limitations of the study, but also what we feel. I mean, what is our take on this, as well as some advice on how to discuss the results with your treating physician.
What do you think the biggest misunderstanding will be about this study?
I'm concerned about a couple of things, which we are obviously trying to remove. I mean, the first thing is that people will say, you know, they will be, what can I say, angry or frustrated about, oh, this is terrible, you know, and that would just be terrible, right?
Meaning from clinicians and patients all HIV drugs.
Yeah, and, you know, and they're sort of being very pessimistic about the whole thing and so forth. I mean, that's not the point here. The point is that the scientific process means that you identify something, you report it to your colleagues in order to allow for discussions with them, and of course allow for colleagues to then start to go out and look in their own data set on whether they're finding something like this. So we can come to a consensus at some point. It takes time, but the scientific process starts by us reporting it, a new novel finding like this. And, you know, people just need to understand that this process takes time to resolve itself. It will resolve itself, I can guarantee you, whether it takes a year, 2 years, but it will. I mean, there will be studies done, there will be analysis done on cells and whatever to try to understand what is the biological mechanism, if any, and so forth. So this will just stimulate a lot of research.
Biological or genetic? I mean,
or genetic or some other factor that certainly, so that was why, or, you know, to substantiate this. And we're just providing our bit into that. That's one sort of thing that I would hope that people are appreciating, that this is not to make people's lives miserable, but it is actually to help in the longer run to understand what this all means. The second thing is that I would be concerned about people not appreciating relative and absolute risk. This is difficult and complex things to think about. And these 90%, people say, wow, that's a big risk. But as we talked about earlier, I mean, it depends really on your underlying risk. If your underlying risk is low, you know, 90% increased risk remains low.
So and under 1%.
Yeah, but just in that given example, right? So, but we're not used to discussing these issues. I mean, I don't think we as a physician and patient community have spent enough time understanding the difference in relative risk of, for example, 90% with an absolute risk, which is dependent on which person you are. And we need to just have more discussion around that so people get that under their skin and sort of understand that and can intuitively react to that. And so I hope we will avoid sort of that confusion that, you know, this, I've seen, you know, somebody was saying that, so we need to switch all our patients away from a back pain. Heavens no. I mean, that would be the last thing I would be suggesting that people should do. Of course, but there's certain subgroups of the patients that you want to focus on and consider carefully. I mean, why is this patient on a Abacavir? Do they have any other drug options left in patients with high underlying risk? So I hope that people will reflect and ask questions, you know, and have discussions. And we're certainly happy to, if people find other questions that they have about the study, you know, we're very happy to discuss that and provide clarity. I mean, our purpose here is to try to provide a transparent reporting of findings that we have done. We're reporting them in complete honesty to the process that we have done, and they are here to be discussed.
A few more questions, I guess, about the population. Was this an older population, or what was the average age?
When the patients came into the study a couple of years ago, they were around 38 to 40 years old. They've obviously grown older as a consequence of the study continuing, so they're now, you know, 43, 44, 45 years old. But that's the typical HIV population.
Right, so it's an older population who have higher risk in any case.
The risk is gradually growing as you are getting old. I mean, cardiovascular disease is an age-related risk. So, right, I mean, that's where you see the heart attacks. It's in, you know, when the people get into the 50s, if you're male. You as a woman, of course, you're delaying that risk by around 10 years. So I mean, that's how cardiovascular risk behaves in the background population, the general population. And so certainly it reacts in the same way in HIV patients. So. Mm-hmm.
Right. So in terms of understanding this risk, so if I'm a 25-year-old HIV-positive male, or I'm a clinician with lots of patients in their 20s,
This is irrelevant. I mean, that's not the focus of discussions between a physician and the patient, these findings. That's not relevant. I mean, there is many, many other issues in 25-year-old that is much, much more important to focus on.
Than this possible risk.
Yeah. I mean, there is many, many other things that you need to put into consideration. But clearly, if you are talking to a 55-year-old male that smokes, I mean, you need to have a serious discussion with this person, not only about Abacavir, but maybe he should stop smoking, right? Maybe he should do more exercise. Maybe we should put him on a statin to lower his cholesterol level. I mean, maybe we should check his blood pressure. Has his blood pressure, is that okay? Is it elevated? Do we need to treat that? I mean, HIV, just because you're HIV infected, I mean, you can get affected by all the other diseases that the general population are affected by, and we know that, right? If we think a little bit more carefully about this, hypertension is a problem, diabetes is a problem in older population, especially if they're obese. And so, I mean, these factors behaves in the same way if you are infected with HIV as opposed to not infected. I mean, HIV is not protecting you from all these problems.
So are you making any changes with your patients since the results came out 3 months ago?
These results came out yesterday.
Oh, yesterday, sorry.
So these are now in the public domain, and we are certainly going to I will talk to my own patients and certain of them to discuss with them carefully about the results and then jointly come to a conclusion and possibly switch. But I would say that's a discretion between me and my patient, and he needs to weigh in as well as I in that decision. I just need to make sure that they understand what the findings are. So,
but would you be talking to only the older patients and those with higher risks, or would you be talking to also the patients who were just infected, they're 22 and...
I would certainly focus my discussion on the older. And I would probably, in the younger, I would probably be much more focused if they're smoking, for example, and you're... Why don't you quit your smoke? I mean, that's a good advice. I mean, I think that's very helpful, not only for your cardiovascular risk, but a variety of other. And, you know, 50% of the HIV population that we're studying are smokers.
In Europe.
Yeah. So I mean, that's a real health problem. And so that would probably be my main discussion points in the younger population. It would be equally well in the older, but there I may want to say, why don't we switch this drug if we have other viable options?
Okay, and finally, I want you to tell our audience a little bit about this amazing cohort of 33,000 people in many countries. How did it start, and where...
Well, it started as a consequence of discussions that a small group of us had with the European Medicine Evaluation Agency, EMEA, which is the European equivalent to the FDA, of us being slightly concerned that although it was great that all these drugs came about, you know, in 96, 97, that the randomized trials that was the basis of getting on the market was very small and very short term. And we were concerned that there was not a plan to monitor and assess what would happen in the longer run when you're using these drugs. You know, we started to get interested in the metabolic problems, the dyslipidemia, et cetera, and there was a lot of reports coming out from 97 to 99. So we got together and discussed this and agreed that this is something that needs focus. And
who got together?
So we were a group of people that got together in parallel with a discussion between me and Professor Ian Weller from the University College London, as well as the European Medicine Evaluation Agency. And there was a quite famous meeting in March 1999 at the EMEA in London, where this was sort of put on the table as a problem that needed to get attention. And then we got all the cohorts together. We surveyed essentially the world for who was able and had an existing cohort that provided good quality information. And then we discussed in these cohorts together. There's a very good network, international network among cohorts, particularly in Europe, but also in the United States and Australia. So we agreed that we need to team up because these are going to be relatively rare events. So none of the cohorts could by themselves address this question. So we teamed up as a group, 11 cohorts got together, merged our respective databases, agreed on a common platform of data collection of the myocardial infarctions and other outcomes. And then it sort of evolved itself. And the primary focus to begin with was myocardial infarction, but now we're moving into liver disease, we're moving into non-AIDS-defining malignancies, we're moving into chronic kidney failure. You know, these events that is of concern at the moment, but where we don't really still know exactly how big of a problem this is. And so we're trying to develop this into a more sort of comprehensive surveillance system to make sure that we are able to identify emerging safety problems.
And I understand the entire HIV-positive population of the Netherlands is included in this cohort.
For example, so there's national cohorts with a very good infrastructure and very good data quality in Holland. In Switzerland, for example, also there's an extraordinary strong group. There is other areas where not necessarily all patients are involved, but a fair chunk of the patients are involved in various cohort studies. So it's obviously... We needed a lot of patients. We could calculate that before we even got the study started, that we needed a lot of patients in order to have enough endpoints to start saying something about this. So it wouldn't be enough to have a couple of thousands. So we needed a lot of patients. But the trick here is, if you want to get a study going like this and get it sustainable, is to make sure that the people who's involved in collecting the data are providing good quality data and are able to follow the patients over a long period of time. Right? This is a chronic disease, so therefore long-term follow-up of patients are vital to maintain the integrity of these studies. So, and there is a lot of good groups out there who is doing a lot of work. We have over 200 clinics around the world who are participating in DAD. So there's a huge number of people who is involved. You know, if they see a patient with a myocardial infarction, then they report that finding into the cohort that then reports it to us in Copenhagen, which is the coordinating center. And it's a huge international network, which have now been existent for 8 years. And I hope we can continue to do this sort of work, because I find this to be very important. And we obviously a big group who are in consensus on that and want to focus on this as an area of research. Not the only one, but one area of research.
Very interesting. Dr. Lundgren, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.